Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
Madam, tell me again, what kind of spider is our Janet?
Our Janet is a razorback angora red spider, one of the largest and rarest of her kind.
Well, I think she's quite a fascinating lady, and perhaps just a bit too visible currently. She's launched herself in a big web on the veranda.
Oh dear, that would be a shock of a greeting for our guests. Would you be a sweetie and try to lure her down with a few pounds of beef, please?
I'd be delighted to, madam.
Good evening. Right this way, everyone. How good of you to visit.
Yes.
Oh, and don't you look lovely? Oh, we're all so happy to see you. Isn't it an eerily calm night so far? Greetings, Mr. Cornblow. Yes. You'd like to volunteer here at the library? Yes, I am aware that you're a retired librarian. How nice. Let me address the room with your inquiry before I give you an answer exclusively, all right? Please, find your way to a spot away from the books, please. Welcome to the Midnight Library, my dear guests. I am your humble host, Miranda Merrick. Thank you for finding your way to us this fine night. I see 2 empty spots. Does everyone who traveled here with a friend still have them? Well, I'm sure there's a totally normal and non-horrific reason for their disappearance. I mean, their delay. They're probably just delayed. We'll keep an eye out for them. As you were making your way into the reading room just now, perhaps you overheard Mr. Cornblow talking with me. Mr. Cornblow is, as many of you know, a longtime relic. Resident of the village. And he brought up a subject I've been meaning to address with you for quite some time. Mr. Cornblow was kindly inquiring if he might volunteer here. Isn't that amazing? And sweet? And courageous? You may be surprised to hear that we have had a few volunteers over the years, and a few helpers are still here with us, as they became part of the fold, as it were, after being, initiated into our customs and ways. There's a pesky rumor that one volunteer became lost and was never seen again, and that's not true. We saw her. We count. Anyway, part of the concern with helping out here is the dire need for one to follow our exact instructions. And timing is extremely important. Because, as you know, the many of us here, keep unconventional hours, a factor which needs to be respected by everyone. I'm a proverbial night owl, and Mr. Darling and his brothers tend to hunt in the evenings and at night, and they nap frequently during the day. Some of the others are a little less predictable. So, if, for example, you're asked to show up at 4:06 a.m. and you make it here, I should say arrive, if you arrive rudely early at 4 a.m. on the dot, well, there could be a problem. And not everyone might want to do what needs to be done. Like feeding the red spiders. Our Janet and her offspring could sometimes use a willing body, you see, and hardly anyone likes to be assigned this task. I think it's the color and sizes, and perhaps the immense numbers of the red spiders, that human people are ill-equipped, ill-prepared for. I'm sure you've all seen those nearly microscopic, tiny little red spiders that crazily run about and zigzag in seemingly meaningless ways. Well, first, it's not meaningless. They're sniffing for prey. And B, they get bigger. Their head, thorax, and legs turn a beautiful ruby blood red, and their plump, egg-sized abdomens turn varying hues of flesh colors. And, well, when they're bigger, you can at least hear their legs tapping as they scurry. It's not like when they're wee tiny, and you could have several in your hair or in the folds of your clothing and not even know it. Anyway, no one who has volunteered yet has wanted to help feed them. Yet. So we may have to find something else for these people to do. Oh my, look at the time. If you've not yet made your selection from the hospitality tray, please do so now. I see several of you have decided to try the little sugar skull candies and cookies that our Natasha has so lovingly prepared. Coincidentally enough, these treats tend to attract the red spiders. Speaking of the iced skull treats, I don't know just yet if there's quite enough material to present an entire reading on the attractive and artistically painted skulls so prominent in the Mexican Day of the Dead celebrations, but I'll certainly look into it. Those festival skulls are made of papier-mâché, wood, sugar paste, and sometimes even carved bone, and then creatively painted with lace loops or flower petals around the empty eye sockets, and then scrolling vines and lines and astronomical or religious images are thrown in elsewhere on the skulls, all done up in bright eye-catching colors. It's very popular for many people taking part in the lively dead celebration to paint their very own faces as though they were dead, with fleshless skulls, in this flashy and fun way. But what I want to tell you about tonight, my lovelies, is more grim than this. Just as much fun, in my opinion, but definitely more grim. because this form of skull painting takes place after death, on actual skulls. It's a form of artwork performed upon the dead. Oh, I do apologize. Just saying that put a chill, a happy little chill, right down my spine. This practice of painting directly onto the skull part of a deceased person. Well, let me just describe a few of the types of artistic images that may be found upon these dear departed ones. You've probably all seen a real skull, if not, see me after the reading. If not, you're hopefully familiar with or have seen or perhaps own a ceramic or plastic prop skull, which can be of such tremendous quality that they may be mistaken for a real skull, which is a good excuse to keep in mind. Anyway, the bare-boned skull, mostly without the bottom mandible, is painted by hand and generally by a caring relative or monk. The top of the skull or forehead often features the dead person's name in bold black Gothic calligraphy, and sometimes the name is accompanied with their birth date and or death date. So, for example, the skull would read, Bob Cornblow, born March 7, 1946, died June 25th, 2023. Oh, no relation to you, Mr. Cornblow. Yours was just the first name that came to mind. There are also often graceful, traipsing-colored vines that encircle the skull in a Julius Caesar-type way, with the person's name between the pretty parted leaves. Also, ringlets of different flowers are seen on the skulls, as well as ornate scrolling frames that contain the deceased's personal information, and sometimes their title, their occupation, or status. Religious symbols, of course, also abound on these painted heads of the dead. Now, I know what you're thinking, which I cannot repeat out loud, but I also know what you're thinking about this. You're thinking, what? Where is this happening? Why would anyone do this? And how much does it cost? And one or two of you are wondering if you can take part in the painting of the skulls. My, we do love our guests. Well, there are most certainly some decorated skulls going back to ancient times, even with some skulls being carved with odd writing and symbols, or knife marks for other reasons. But this organized, intentional, and reliably done artwork is what we're laying out for you here tonight. And one of the most expansive collections, the pictures of which can easily be found and viewed, is located in the quaint town of Hallstatt, Austria. Hallstatt has wonderfully embraced and preserved its enchanting past, and has valued and kept many of its charming medieval-style churches, public buildings, and homes. Beginning in the 1700s, the church oversaw the digging up, dismembering, and decorating of their dead's skulls, in order to store them in what was and is referred to as a bine house or bone house for safekeeping. More than 1,200 skulls reside inside the bine house, also called a charnel house. Of these, about half are lavishly painted with crosses and ivy vines and laurel leaves. The names of the person who once occupied the sun-bleached skull is also finely lettered onto it, some with wreaths of roses to symbolize the deep love for the vacated occupant. And apparently, you can visit them. Isn't that nice? For the past several centuries, the people of Hallstatt have been lovingly hand-painting the skulls of their dead loved ones and setting them out for display in their churches. This artful adoration can be done by family members, but it seems most of the artistic activity was or is done by the church's monks. The last person to have their skull admitted to this very full collection passed away in 1983. It was this woman's final request to have her skull included with all the others in Hallstatt's bone house, and her wish was granted in 1995. Better late than never. Oh, and what a coincidence, dear guests. Tonight's reading in the Midnight Library is brought to you by Brother Burgess's Skull Painting Services. You're only alive for a little while. Life is too darn short. Let's discuss your eternal style, your fashion a la mort. Once you've sloughed off your mortal coil, your bones will need stripped. They could be chewed or even boiled, or baked or acid dipped. Your skull is the most important part. It'll go to Brother Burgess. He'll cover it with his hellish art, his demonic painting service. He'll paint horns upon your head with a ring of demons at play. It doesn't matter, 'cause you'll be dead, but brazenly on display. You might be a Halloween prop, painted up all scary, or on a spike on the rooftop, here in the Midnight Library. Find Brother Burgess in any number of places, wandering the cemetery, under the stairs at the church rectory, and he's always at casino night, down at the Broom and Fang pub. Remember, dear guests, we're not encouraging corpse thuggery, just a little harmless skullduggery. Ah, Brother Burgess. I shouldn't tell you this, dear guests, but he sometimes attends these readings with you in disguise. He is so clever in his camouflage. He could be sitting right next to you, perhaps in the guise of a village washerwoman, and you wouldn't even know it. So, these hand-painted heads of the dead. I understand the main question you have is, why? Why do this downright ghoulish thing? And then go so far as to put the dead heads on display? Well, you went to your local council meeting and stood up and proposed this, saying, I think it would be nice if we dug up our dead and chopped off their heads and painted their names on their skulls with a few daisies on them, and then stacked them up in the churches so everyone could see them again.
This probably wouldn't fly today. But this is probably because of several reasons. One possibly being that modern people aren't as much fun, but the main reason this was begun, being done hundreds of years ago, was to save space. Yes, the land was and still is a valuable commodity for many towns around the world. The precious plot space is needed for farmland, pasture land, and living space. But these people still wanted to honor and to know their dearly departed. So this system was created. Let me walk you through one centuries-long example, so it's not quite as off-putting for some. In Russia, since the 10th century, the monasteries of Mount Athos have been known for their rigorously holy treatment of their dead. They employ a series of steps that includes the initial burial, daily prayers for the dead, exhumation of the dead, followed by preparations performed upon the remains, and then the permanent display of their dead. First, you should know that the soil of Mount Athos is barely soil at all. It is mainly composed of pebbles, stones, and boulders. In the past, in order to have enough tenable soil in which to grow some meager crops, such as gourds and cabbages, the Russian monastery of Mount Athos actually had tons of viable soil shipped to them just to be able to grow these few vegetables. So, when a priest, referred to as a brethren, passes away on Mount Athos, for whatever reason, the others do not tend to the newly deceased in any way. The body is not washed, the clothes are not changed, and there is no funeral held that the family might attend. The book we have here states that these holy men do not indulge in too much self-care or health care in general, so their deaths, it seems, are just part of their lives, if that makes sense. The deceased brethren is buried as quickly as possible, that very day even. His fellow priests or monks dig down into the rock bed just a few feet down and expeditiously entomb him without a tomb. Just the body goes into the stony grave and is then covered with some genuinely rare earth, just enough to cover him up. A large black cross with the freshly buried corpse's name painted on it is then driven into the ground at the head of the new grave, and he is left to rest, undisturbed and safe and sound, for 3 years. Then, things become very interesting. The fellow brethren of the monastery who have been praying for their deceased friend for all of this time, at the end of the three-year processing period, then they disinter him. His remains are then thoroughly examined to see if all of his flesh has been, this is their words, not mine,
accepted by the earth. If there is still some residual flesh clinging to the skeleton, this is a sign that the earth is not willing to fully receive him. The Anthonite monks believe then that the departed may not have been totally successful in his mission as a priest. They also believe this to be a clear message that since his body has remained here, that his soul may not have gained entrance or found peace in heaven. So, they dutifully rebury the unready dead person and begin to pray much more diligently for his redemption. They also wait for several months or even a year longer before finally removing his bare bones once again from his temporary grave. And when he is finally ready, his spot is then given to the next reposed brethren. So there's a rotation of bodies going into and then back out of the graves at all times. When a bare skeleton is ready, it is now when they wash the skeleton ceremoniously with water and wine. And although it may seem extremely odd to many of us, well, not us, but you, the skeleton is then dismembered. I'm sure with great reverence and care, the delicate bones of the hands and feet are put into sacks and stacked upon the others against a wall in the underground part of the ossuary of St. Andrew's Skeet. The long bones are gently stacked in cupboards and casements with the hundreds and hundreds of long bones of the others from centuries and centuries past. The cleaned skull of the priest is then bedecked with its vital information. These skulls, the ones lined up on so many shelves in countless rows, actually do go from current times all the way back to the 10th century and can be viewed by some visitors to the remote monastery, but is open to the members of the clergy at all times. There are believed to be roughly 700 hand-painted skulls here. Another unique bit of interesting lore, I should say fact, as it is believed by the monks, that the color of the dead monks' skulls are said to be a clear message regarding the validity of the monks' righteousness. Warm yellow skulls that almost have a sheen or luster about them are thought to have been the holiest monks. They may even exude a sweet scent that one can smell. Pale white skulls are still a sign that these monks were faithful in their works and vows. But a dark skull, well, we would welcome them onto our shelves in our catacombs. If we had any catacombs, that is, which we do not. I would like to mention just one more group of ancient painted skulls before I break the rules entirely just a bit to entertain you, my dear guests. There is yet another monastery in Romania, dating back to the 1400s, in which many of the Orthodox skulls of the holy men and priests there have their portraits painted upon their skulls. So you could imagine the tiny painted face just a bit larger and covering the whole skull, I guess. A bit like getting a tattoo of your face on your face. These portraits are really rather well done, even though the fellows in them do bear a striking resemblance to each other. All being elderly men with long white beards and the exact same robes, and all with a look of, I'm not sure, they all look tired or terse or unfulfilled or something. Now, I have to admit, my lovelies, I'm including this last painted lady, even though she's a bit of an overachiever. When I read of the discovery of her, well, I found her to be irresistible. She's earned her right to be counted amongst these rare beings here because her skull was painted after her death. My own skull is already painted beneath my skin, but I won't tell you about that another time. Anyway, she was not on display in a church or a bone house with so many others. She was found alone, by fate, by accident. In 1994, as a young archaeologist was routinely pulling weeds and clearing dust and rubble from the collapsed stairs of an ancient temple in Chiapas, Mexico, she spied down through the crack in the stairs into a large chamber, a burial chamber with bright stone walls that surrounded a heavy sarcophagus. The collapsed skeleton of a small boy lay beside the sarcophagus, some speculating that this boy was sacrificed in honor of the one occupying the sarcophagus. The sweeping archaeologist had just found a royal tomb in what was known as Temple 13. When the noble Mayan sarcophagus was opened, the contents were unlike any that had been seen before. Inside rested the skeleton of a queen. Her entire skull was painted a brilliant fiery red, and so was every other bone of her tall, regal skeleton. Every one of her bones was permeated with the crimson color. Even the inner walls of her fine sarcophagus were coated with the radiant red paint, and she immediately became known as the Red Queen. She was the most famous discovery in the region in 40 years, and no one knew who she was. On her face was placed a splendid jade crystal mask, and decorative shells and beads were placed upon her red bones. But her crypt bore not a single solitary inscription as to her identity. No one knew who she was. But there were clues in her proximity to another royal tomb. The pyramid tomb of the king Pekau, whose elaborate burial site was discovered in 1943. It was filled with riches and carvings and inscriptions. From these, historical experts deduced that the Red Queen was one of four women related to the famous king. Since he had no daughters and no sisters, the Red Queen was either his wife, his mother, his grandmother, or his sister-in-law, which was least likely. After 15 long years of studying and waiting for the advancements in forensic genealogy to become available, they discovered through DNA analysis of the bones and teeth of the skeletal pair that they were not related and were likely husband and wife, making the Red Queen a true queen. It is thought that the two produced a son, whose royal tomb is yet to be found. The Red Queen's skeleton is believed to be about 1,300 years old. Yes, Mr. Cornblow? Did she have red spiders in her tomb with her? I don't know. I suppose it's possible. Listen, dear Mr. Cornblow. You know, I think you would be the ideal person to feed the red spiders to help out as a volunteer here. So please, just stay in your seat, and I'll have Irma fetch the appropriate forms for you to fill out. You can just skip the next of kin bit when you come to it. As for the rest of you, my dear guests, you're free to go. That didn't sound right. We hate to see you go. Oh, well. Please follow Mr. Darling as he leads you safely to the way out. Good night, my dear guests. Good night.
Well, darling, how did Janet enjoy Mr. Cornblow's, feeding? Is she fat and happy? I hear buzzing.
Well, offspring are happy. I've never heard such a ruckus.
Oh, that's their baby rattles, darling. I believe Stefan made each of them a tiny rattle.
He made 8 rattles for each of the 800 new babies. It's deafening downstairs. Thank goodness her older offspring left with our guests.
Right. We're nothing if not charitable to our guests. Imagine the itching. The Midnight Library would like to thank everyone at Astonishing Legends. Our excellent sound design is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. If you are enjoying your evenings in the reading room, we invite you to join your dark companions and help keep the Midnight Library open and the beasties fed. Please visit patreon.com/midnightlibrary, where you can contact me directly. Seek us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Our bizarre merch can be found at redbubble.com/people/midnightlibrary.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.